thing.
Testing, testing.
And Mr. Clifford DeShane, who has agreed to participate in our Gift of Experience, the Oral History Project at the Boston Hemophilia Center. And thank you for agreeing to do this today, Cliff.
You're welcome.
Cliff has decided to sign the full disclosure on the consent. And it is September 15th, Wednesday, 2004, and we are actually sitting in the Brigham and Women's Hospital conducting this interview. So welcome, Cliff, and thank you for coming. Let me start by asking, tell me a little bit about where you were born, who you grew up with, when you were born, and how old you are today.
Let's see. I was born in Lawrence. In 1954.
Lawrence, Massachusetts?
Lawrence, Mass. And basically, my parents were Henry DeShane and Teresa DeShane. I've had two sisters, Linda and Debbie.
Younger or older?
I have one older, one younger. The older one is 3 years older than I am. The younger one is 1 year younger than I am. And right now I'm presently 50 years old because I was born in 1954.
And what are your diagnoses?
My diagnoses are...
What a way to put it, huh?
Let's see. I have classic hemophilia, factor VIII deficiency, severe.
Severe.
I'm HIV positive. I have arthritis. I also have hepatitis C. Pretty much.
That covers it.
That's pretty much all of it.
So, Cliff, tell me about growing up with your two sisters and your parents. First, tell me a little about your parents. Where did they come from? What was their education? What were they like?
My parents, basically, they were brought up in Lawrence. They were born in Lawrence. And they, I think my mom finished high school. My dad, at the time, that was during World War II, so I think he didn't finish. I think he missed the senior year because basically he signed up, or he did finish, and then he signed up right after. I'm not quite sure on that.
So he fought in the war.
Well, he was in the war, but it wasn't that he really fought. He was basically on one of the ships, and because he was in the Navy,
wow.
And he was on a transport most of the time. So you go across, bring supplies, and then come back, and so that's most of the time what he did.
Are you the first person in your family to have hemophilia?
Yep, first person. And they basically tried at the time trace it back, and they couldn't find any trace back.
No family history?
Couldn't find it.
When do you first remember having hemophilia?
Well, they told me I was about 2 years old.
And what was the story they told you?
Well, my youngest sister at the time, fooling around, and she had a small plastic shovel or a small steel shovel at the time, and she hit me, and basically my chest all bruised. So my parents were concerned, so they brought me up to the hospital to have it checked out, and they ended up keeping me in the hospital, not for the bruise on the chest, because the doctor said that was all taken care of. But when the doctor went to grab my hand, I pulled away. Come to find out, I had a sore wrist. So they basically put me in the hospital to treat the sore wrist at the time.
And what hospital was this, do you know?
More than likely it was the Children's, Boston uh-huh. Children's Hospital.
Uh-huh. And did they actually know that you had hemophilia once you were at that time?
I think by then they knew I had it.
And what are your first memories, actually, of having hemophilia? How was it for you?
When I was in grade school, basically. I was in the hospital quite often, and that was at least once a month I'd be in the hospital. And I'd be in the hospital anywhere from a week to 2 weeks for a bleed.
Every month, Cliff?
Just about.
With what? What was going on?
Oh, either I blew my knee out, or I blew an elbow out, or you throw your shoulder out.
So you spent half your life during your school years in the
Pretty
hospital?
Much.
Which hospital?
The Children's Hospital.
What was that like?
It just became a routine after a while. Because that's what you had, and at the time they didn't have the treatment that they have today. If you had a bleed, you had to be admitted into the hospital because to treat you at the time they had to use plasma. So it was so much volume that it just took hours and hours for it to drip through. So.
And would you have the plasma every day you were in the hospital for hours and hours?
I would get it twice a day. I'd get it in the morning, a dose, and then at nighttime get another dose, and do that for basically the whole time I was in the hospital.
So you were stuck in bed getting this?
Well, you were stuck in bed, but you weren't stuck in bed, because they basically had the modified wheelchairs to put the cots. And you basically got in one of those, and you had your IV pole, and you learned how to maneuver it.
Would anyone be with you when you were in the hospital? How did that work?
Basically, my dad would always be the one who brings me in.
Your dad would?
Yeah, my dad used to always bring me in if I had a bleed. He'd stay with me until I got situated in the hospital. Then he'd go back and do what he had to do. And he always came every night.
He came every night?
Every night. He'd go to work all day, and then after he got out of work, he'd drive all the way back into Boston, stay with me until 8 o'clock, and then drive all the way home.
Wow. And what about your mom?
My mom, at the time, she was probably working second shift, so and she didn't drive, so sometimes if I had appointments in the afternoon, one of her friends would drive her in, and then she would take me in. But most of the time, it was my dad who took the time off, and we had to come in and do what we had to do.
What do you remember your parents' attitude was toward this?
It's hard to say, really. It's
hard to remember or hard to say?
Hard to really remember, because basically they were just doing what they had to do to get by.
Yeah. Were they anxious? Were they protective of you? Was it just, this is what it is?
They were probably protective, because basically it was, don't do this, don't ride bikes, don't play sports, don't run. So there was a lot of restrictions that you had to abide by. If you abide by them, you probably didn't get a bleed as often. If you didn't abide by them, you ended up with a bleed more often. So it was.
Did you abide by them or didn't you abide by
most
them?
Most of the time I abided.
You did?
Yeah. Once in a while, you're a kid, I'm going to try it anyway. And you pay for it.
Yeah. But it sounds like you paid for it no matter what.
Yeah.
Whether you did or didn't, somehow.
And I would, because I was just a severe bleeder, and I would get a joint bleed. And back then, basically, if you got a joint bleed, like on a knee or an elbow, they would basically aspirate it, put it in the cast, and you'd have it in the cast for 4 weeks.
So you were you in a cast often?
Oh yeah, I have pictures at home where I have like a double leg cast and an arm cast on, or two arm casts and a leg cast. But it's just something that, as you got going, when you go to the hospital, you always seen somebody who was worse than you were. So it was like, okay, this.
Let's go to the hospital for a minute. They must have known you.
Yeah, they got to know me very well.
And you them.
Yeah.
What were they like? How were they toward you? Do you remember?
Yeah, most of the people were fine. In other words, they had the doctor at the time who was in charge of hemophilia was Dr. Strauss, and they had the others below them. But when I used to go in and they used to have to set up an IV, a lot of the times the doctors couldn't get an IV started, because at the time I was fat.
You were fat?
I was fat. I was in the second grade and I weighed 120 pounds. So I was as high as I was wide. And Dr. Strauss basically says, you don't need all that weight. Don't do you any good. So basically, I just cut out a lot of stuff just to make it through. I never really lost weight. I just grew after that. But anytime I used to go in and the doctors couldn't find the vein, they'd try once, maybe they tried a second time, and then my dad would say, that's it, no more. You don't get a third shot.
So what would happen?
Well, they'd call Dr. Strauss down there, and he would take the time, and he would always get it on the first shot.
So your dad was really there to to advocate for you, to protect you.
Yeah. And I was basically, they got two shots. After that, it was like, hey, get somebody else.
When you had to go into the hospital, do you remember how you felt about it?
Well, most of the time it was, you didn't really want to, but it was like, yeah, got no choice.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to go to the hospital. I'll hold off. But the more you held off, the longer it stayed. So it was like, okay.
So you just knew it had to be.
It had to be. But a lot of times you wouldn't really say you had a bleed. You'd try getting going through it yourself. And
what do you mean by that? You tried going through it yourself?
Basically, just get quiet.
Not tell.
But after a while, they noticed because either you couldn't use an arm or you weren't walking too well. And it was like, what's bothering you? Oops.
So it's kind of hard to...
Yeah, it's kind of tough.
Yeah, no, but you tough. Would try to do that occasionally.
You try.
Yeah. Did kids tease you in school? What was that like? Because they must have seen you go in and out or come with casts. How were the kids to you at school?
Kids at school were fine. I was just another person to them. I had crutches, so it didn't matter. It was like, okay, so you're on crutches. So most of the time, the kids were fine. Every now and then, you get somebody who'd be a little wise guy, but there's always one in the crowd.
Yeah.
And, but that was, like, for recess and stuff, I used to stay in the class.
You didn't even go out?
I didn't even go out for recess. And, well, we only lived a block from the school, so it wasn't like I had a long walk or anything. So, but recess, a lot of times, I would just stay in the classroom. And the main corridors of the hallways, I would be on crutches and basically ain't supposed to run in the hallways. So I was racing kids up and down the hallway with crutches. But they just, it was something I had to do and I just did it. It wasn't anything else.
What was it like? I'm just going to hop back to the hospital for a minute. What was it like being a kid alone in the hospital for such periods of time?
Well, you were never really alone because you were never really in a private room. You were in a room with probably 5-6 other kids. Because a lot of the rooms back then were like six in a room or four in a room. So there was always other kids in the room. They may not have had hemophilia, but they had their problems. And by seeing other kids with other problems, I used to say, I'm not too bad because he's worse than I am.
You remember thinking that?
I remember thinking that because there was one kid in there, I forget what disease he had, but basically, if a feather hit him, basically, he could break a bone. Now it's his bones were that brittle, and he was in the hospital, and it was like he's worse than I am, so I'm not that bad. So,
did your parents ever get mad at you for getting a bleed?
No.
So they didn't ever blame you for getting a bleed either.
No, it's got a bleed. It just got to the point where okay, you got a bleed. We got to go into Boston. Got to take care of it. Now, if they resented it a little bit, they never showed it.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
what about your sisters? How were they around it? Do you remember?
My sisters were fine.
They were?
Yeah, we got along fine.
How did it affect your being able to do your schoolwork?
Never.
Missing so much school.
Just 1 year, I think they brought a tutor in to keep me up with it. But I had no problem staying with the class.
You didn't?
Because I remember one time I was out for almost 2 weeks when they were learning a whole new section in math, and I ended up going in like on a Friday and they were having a test that day, and I said, look, I'll take the test. They says, well, you don't know it. I says, have somebody show me what you did in the last 2 weeks and I'll take the test. So they said, okay. So they basically showed me and I took the test and I passed the test. So it was like...
So you were a capable student.
Yeah. I just didn't apply myself all the time. I applied if I wanted to, and that was the subjects I liked, like science, math, those I liked, so I would apply myself. The Englishes and the histories, it was just something to, okay, you have to take.
You know, you talk about this as, hey, I just took it in stride, but when you describe it, it really affected your quality of life in the sense that you were pulled out of your home, pulled out of your school often. And put in the hospital.
Yeah.
How do you explain just sort of going with the flow?
It's just either you go with the flow or drive you nutty. So you basically have to either accept it, and if you accept it, then it's just a way of life. If you don't accept it, then it's going to cause a lot more problems. That's the way I ended up looking at it. And that's how I always made it through. You know, it was, I'll take today as it is, and however tomorrow comes, I'll deal with it.
Did your parents have that? Do you think that came from a family attitude, or was that just you?
Probably had to be part of the family, because whenever they did anything, I was always included. You know, it wasn't like I was excluded because I had the hemophilia. You know, if they did something, we all went. It was the whole family went. In other words, if they went to the beach, I went to the beach. And many a times I was on the beach, I had cast on. So,
so they always...
I was part of...
The hemophilia was never the driving...
No. It was, hey, it's something that you have, something you got to live with. So you just, like anybody else who has any other disease, basically you learn to live with it and just keep going.
Do you remember what the caregivers were like to you, the doctors and nurses?
Oh, they were all great.
They were?
They were all great.
You don't have any
no
specific memories about any particular hospitalization? Or
no, they were all good caregivers. And basically I got there, basically I got treated, like I said, for anywhere from a week to 2 weeks until basically the bleed was subsided enough until I was to go home and go home on crutches and cast and... Basically, go back to the clinic every 2 weeks to get checked out. Okay, this bleed's all set. Then they get you off that, and then you throw like the next leg out. So then you're back again, and you start the thing all over again. So it was like you just a routine.
Wow. So it's just really part of your routine.
Just part of the routine after a while.
Yeah. And now let's get a little older, Cliff. When you were in high school, you know, when the school probably demands got tougher or the kids got older. What was it the same thing in high school that you were in and out of the hospital all the time?
Well, by then I knew my restrictions and you start abiding by them a little bit more than when you're younger. So I had fewer bleeds.
You did have fewer bleeds.
Yeah, I had fewer bleeds. But I would still be on crutches more often. And basically back then that was actually about the time I got in high school. They start offering basically the prophylactic care, but that was being treated every other day. But at the time, you couldn't do it at home. So every other night, me and my dad would drive all the way into Boston Children's Hospital. I would go up, and at the time, I was getting cryo, which they were using. So I used to get my cryo, go to the blood bank, talk to the people up there because they knew me on a first-name basis. They knew when I was coming in, and basically it was like, okay, yeah. It's over there in that refrigerator.
So you would get cryo on a prophylactic basis?
That's how they started it originally.
Oh, tell me about that. What happened?
Well, basically that was when they were thinking if they brought the levels up that it would help people leave a more normal life. So I was one of the first ones they asked if I wanted to go on that type of program.
How do you know you were one of the first ones?
They told me.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of the stuff... Anytime they were doing a trial, they'd ask me if I would try the trial. And 9 out of 10 times I said, yeah, okay, I'll try it. It's just, and I'm still doing the same thing today. I still tell them yes. Sometimes I fight them, but I still end up saying yes.
So they said, we're going to try to give you cryo every other day?
Yeah, so I used to go in every other night after supper.
From Lawrence?
From Lawrence. My dad would get out of work, pick me up. We were driving to Boston, go down to the emergency room in the at the children's, go up to the blood bank, because basically in the emergency room, they'd give me all the paperwork. I'd go up to the blood bank, get my cryo, bring it back down to the emergency room, and then I had to wait around for a doctor. And basically I did that for 2-3 years.
2 or 3 years?
2 or 3 years, because I think I started that when I was a sophomore.
In high school.
In high school. Junior year. That was the year I got my license. So for 6 months while I was on my permit, they said I was driving in and out with my dad, but I was driving. So the day I turned 16 and a half, I got my license, and he basically handed me the keys and says, see ya, you're on your own. So basically, I would come in every other night, and it was just a routine. It was just, okay, got to go to Boston.
So your social life was sitting in the emergency room at Children's
Hospital.
Well,
back then, because I had used to wait for a doctor. And then there was one particular doctor that happened to have do me that night. And she asked me, she said, would you like to learn how to do it yourself? She says, this way here, you don't have to wait for any doctor down in the emergency. You can come in. Find a room that's open, just take the room that's open, do your injection, and then out of here.
But with cryo?
With cryo. Because the cryo, it was much more concentrated than the plasma, but it's not as concentrated as the factor now. You know, the cryo, probably for a dose, it would probably take 2 30 cc syringes. So for injection time, it'd probably take you like 10, 15 minutes.
I see. So she taught you how to do it.
She asked me if I wanted to learn, and I said, sure. So she says, yeah. She gave me her arm, and she says, yeah, put the needle right there. So I put it in on the first shot. She says, okay, would you come in 2 days? She says, come and see me. And she says, I'll let you do it yourself. And after that, I started doing it myself every other night. And then, because I didn't feel like coming in every other night, I started pushing it to every 3 nights, then every 4 nights. And basically, I got off the prophylactic care because I just didn't like time restraints. If I would have stayed on it, I probably wouldn't have had as many joint damage as I got. But you know, it was something. It did improve my life when I was doing it that way. But I found I was able to also push the time frame out further and further.
So you were able to start negotiating with the doctors, whereas
yeah.
before you used to just say, okay, I'll do what you
right.
say.
And so once she showed me, basically, after that, anytime I went into the hospital, I got my own stuff, did my own injections.
How did this affect your social relations in high school? Did you still have friends? Could
oh, yeah.
you date? I mean...
I didn't really date until high school, probably senior year. Because I didn't really... I had friends. You know, I was always... never home. I was never home. I was always out with the friends, playing, hanging around, just doing what kids do.
But you were just on crutches or at a cast?
Yeah,
or
either I had crutches or I had a cast on, but it didn't always stop me. You know, but like I said, when I got in high school, I didn't have the bleeds as often because I was treating it much closer. You know, I would realize I was having a bleed and get it treated before I ended up into a major bleed.
Did your parents or anybody ever go, oh, poor?
You get that.
Did you?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Sometimes I say, what do you mean, poor me? You know, they say, well, you got all this wrong. I says, my mom once in a while, she'll say it. She'll say, oh, poor you. I says, no, not poor me. I says, because we believe in God. Because we are Catholics. So basically, my belief got to, he wouldn't give you anything that you couldn't handle. In other words, if he gave you something, it's because you could handle what he gave you. So so basically that's how I got through it. Because I was brought up as a Catholic, and one of the things of a Catholic is basically, you believe in the God. And so basically I got the attitude that if I couldn't handle it, he wouldn't have given me what I got. So.
So that never challenged your relationship with God to say, God, why did you give me all this stuff to handle?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you curse and you say, hey, why me? But you get over it and yeah, say, okay, all right, I can handle it. So I guess it's all right.
So your faith did play an important role?
Yeah.
And does it still?
Yeah, it has to. In other words, because you got to have that extra, you got to have something to look to. In other words, if you don't have, if it's just physical, you can't deal with it.
What do you mean if it's just physical, you can't deal with it?
If it's just a physical thing, in other words, you got to be able to have something in your mind that helps you to get through it.
I see.
In other words, it may not be a God, it may not be something else, but it's a spiritual thing. It's, you got to basically get to a different level to handle it.
Do you remember when you got to that different level?
Probably sometime in high school. And I was, but even when I was younger, before high school, I would be in the hospital and I always had a smile on my face. So it was something that was always me.
This is so moving, Cliff. So. Tell me about pain. Were you in much pain?
Yeah, you know, it was pain. But basically, that's where the next level came, basically. Yeah. Had to get to a point where you could block it out. So
how do you block pain out?
It's tough.
You actually do it?
Yeah, until it gets to a certain point, and then I can't block it out, because then it's beyond my threshold. And once it goes beyond my threshold, then I can't do anything with it.
And then what happens when it's beyond your threshold?
Then that means I got to get something taken care of. Then I see a doctor and basically get treated for it. And
I see. So sometimes you wouldn't attend to the bleed until it went over your pain threshold.
Yeah.
And that at that point, it just pushed you.
It pushed me over.
And then once you went to get treated, weren't you still in pain?
Yeah, but now you know what was causing the pain. Because actually, it happened just this past year.
Tell me.
I had hurt my hip. I was putting a floor down for a couple of days, and basically I got a bleed into a hip. And I got the bleed in the hip. I was controlling the pain, but I wasn't sure what was wrong with the hip. So I had a doubt. So I was taking pain medication, and basically the pain medication wasn't really doing what it was supposed to, because I didn't know exactly whether the hip dislocated or whether I had a bleed or whether, because I got an artificial joint, whether the artificial joint deteriorated and let go. So I got to the point, after 3 days, I was in doubt of what was happening, because I treated it as a bleed, but yeah.
You weren't sure.
I wasn't sure. So that left a doubt. By leaving the doubt, basically my pain got to the point where it was like, I got to get it treated. And then after they checked it out and said it was fine, then I was able to, the pain didn't really go down. I was able to say, okay, this is what's causing the pain, so I can basically maintain it now.
Now that's interesting. So somehow tolerating pain has something to do with knowing what it is or not.
Yep, a lot of times.
Explain that to me. Somehow doubt makes pain worse?
Yeah, I think so. And I would, because most of the time I'll have pain. But there's, as the hospital has, they have the little pictures, and I would, what level of pain. And even people at work will say, oh, your pain threshold is much higher than mine. I says, yeah, that's because I've lived with it all my life. So what you would classify as probably a 5, I'm classifying it as a 1. So it's just the basically an aspect that you're looking at it. It's okay, you're in pain, but how much pain is it? You know, it's a hard thing to quantify.
But if you're familiar with the pain, or you know what the pain is, versus yes, not knowing where it's coming from, how does that make a difference? Do you know?
I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Is it somehow that therefore then you can predict the course of the pain?
Sometimes I could tell I'm having a bleed actually before the pain really kicks in, because I feel something that's not quite right.
But it somehow gives more control of the pain,
yeah,
if you know what it is.
If you know exactly what's causing it, and basically if you know you can treat what's causing it, then you can basically maintain, you could drop the pain.
I see. But if you don't know what it is, then that anxiety...
The anxiety makes it worse.
Huh. So pain isn't only physical. Pain, you're saying, is mental too.
Pain, a lot of it's in the mind. You know, it's physical, but you could control a lot of it with your mind. In other words, you can't eliminate it, but you could make it less severe.
Okay. Did you take pain medication a lot as a kid?
Nope.
Why?
Because I don't.
Why not? Or as an adult, let me put it that way.
Even as an adult, I don't take it that much.
How come?
Just because once I start treating it, and if I realize I can treat it and it's not interfering too much, then I just won't bother. And I was, like last week I had a bleed in my wrist, but I woke up at 12:30 and it was throbbing. So I said, I'll take a couple of Tylenol with codeine, and took that. It took care of the pain, but I also had a reaction to the Tylenol with codeine, because once in a while it just don't agree with me. So, if I don't need it, I try avoiding it.
I see. And so you just somehow integrate the pain into your life.
Yeah. In other words,
and you said you've lived with pain all your life, have you?
Pretty much. In other words, always something sore. You know, it's always had a joint that was sore. Like, most of the time I got a wrist sore now, or I got an elbow that's sore. Back then it used to be my knees or elbows, so...
Let me ask you then about, we sort of talked about how you had to spend half your life in the hospital. Then as you got older in high school, cryo came and you went on prophylaxis, so you just spent every other night in the emergency room. And then you actually could infuse yourself, so you didn't have to spend quite as long in the
right.
emergency room. Then what happened?
Then from there, basically that's when they started with the factor, and they said, we could let you bring the stuff home if you want.
What was that like?
I said, super. So now, instead of having to go to the hospital every other day, like I was, basically I'd go to the hospital because that's where I was picking up my supply. I was going to the children's hospital and picking up like 6 doses. So I'd have it at home for when I needed it. And I just did that afterwards.
What was that like? Did that change your life?
Yeah, because it cut down a lot of time coming to the hospital just to be treated.
And were the how was it to infuse yourself with the factor? Was it hard? Was it easy? Was it fast? What was that like?
I picked up on it quick and basically never had a problem.
So the amount of time that you had to go to the hospital, did that change?
Oh, yeah. You know, when I got in high school, basically my time in the hospital had dropped almost to maybe once a year I'd end up in the hospital, if that, because I was being treated outpatient-wise.
So it made a huge difference.
Made a huge difference for hospital time. And basically, once I got the stuff so I could take it at home, the only time I ever went to the hospital after that was if I had something that had to be done, like when I had my knees replaced and my hips replaced, or a bleeding ulcer, stuff like that, then you have no choice. You got to go into the hospital because you can't take care of that.
Mm-hmm. But for the actual bleeding episodes, you no longer had to come in anymore?
Never came in. And it was, so basically, I would see the doctors like every 6 months, just come in and say hi.
I think that's what's been fascinating about men who have grown up in your time frame of spending so much time in the hospital to really getting to the point where you hardly ever came in.
Yep.
Did you ever reflect on that and go, wow, this is different?
Well, back then they didn't have the treatment that they have today.
Right.
That was the whole thing. In other words, because it was basically new science.
Right.
And it just that it progressed that far in the last 50 years.
And for you, it really made a difference in your lifestyle.
In other words, the last 30 years made the biggest difference.
With having factor at home.
With having factor at home.
Yeah. Now tell me about dating and meeting. When did you meet your wife?
Oh, I met her.
Have you been married just once?
Just once.
Okay. When did you meet your wife?
26 years ago.
26 years ago?
Through my ex-girlfriend.
So you dated Cliff. Got in your way.
I dated. I went out. Did what I wanted. Basically, my wife, I met her, like I said, through my ex-girlfriend. Me and one of my friends were going up to one of the clubs at the time. And we went up to the club and they introduced me. And I ended up going out with her and proceeded on and married her. So.
What about the hemophilia? Was that ever a concern of yours?
Not really. Because I knew my sons couldn't have it. So that was one plus. Only drawback to this, if you have daughters, the daughters become an automatic carrier. So it has its drawbacks, but overall it's fine.
Did your wife have any worries about it?
Sometimes she gets a little anxious about it, but
most
of the time, more concerned, really.
For you?
Yeah. When are you going to do something about it? You got to do this about it. You should go see the doctor.
Now, did you have kids?
Yeah, I have 2 kids.
Yeah? What do you... Tell me about that.
I have a son. He's going to be 23 years old. And I got a daughter who just turned 15.
So not even close to the marrying age.
No.
Yeah.
Still a long way off yet.
Yeah. So she's the one who can pass it down.
She's the one who could pass it along.
Yeah. Have you ever talked with her about it?
Yeah. She actually did a report last year for school. And she had to pick basically a disease. And so she took hemophilia. So she did her research and she asked me questions, so basically she aced the report. So.
Chip off the old shoulder. Tell me, is hemophilia something that's talked about in your home?
No, it's just there. That's
yeah. It. Do your kids ever ask you about it?
No, they know if I'm having a bleed or something. Okay, Dad's got to take his medication. Don't really bother them. It may have bothered my kids a little bit because they probably couldn't do a lot of the things that other people would have done with their kids, like probably bike riding. But when I grew up, it was basically don't bike ride, don't run, don't do this. If I would have stayed on prophylactic, then I could have probably did that, but that wasn't what I did. I basically got to the point where I use it on demand only. So basically, they know when I'm not feeling well. So.
Was that hard for you ever as a dad?
Sometimes.
Sometimes? In what way?
Well, sometimes you'd like to go out and play catch with your kid, but you know if you go out and play catch, you're going to end up paying for it afterwards, so you sort of go, I can't do that.
Did that change the way you related to your kids at all, do you think? Did you find other...
No. We have a good relationship, so I don't think that really affected it.
Okay. Let's move on to the whole period of the early 80s when the whole HIV business came in, the AIDS period. What do you remember about that?
Well, back then, basically they came in and they were saying you'd have HIV if you basically got any types of transfusions.
Who said it? How do you remember hearing about this?
The hospital.
Had you been reading about it in the paper before that, or was that...
Well, I probably read a little bit about it in the paper, but mainly it was from the hospital because at the time my knees were getting ready to go, and I had my knees replaced back in 89.
So how old were you then? Let's see.
I was 30 years old.
30 years
old. At 30 years old, I had to have bilateral knee replacements. And basically, before I had the knee replacements, that was basically when they were having this whole thing with HIV and AIDS. And back then it was, well, if you were getting blood products, the odds are you're infected. That was
the first time you heard about it?
That was basically the first time you're infected.
What was that like to hear?
It was like, okay, so I'm infected. You know, it was like, what about, well, at the time, they didn't really know because, like I said, it was something new. They weren't sure. And they said, well, you should get tested. I said, why should I get tested? You're telling me I'm already infected, so I'm not. Basically, I fought them on getting tested for years.
You didn't want the test.
I figured if I was positive already, why are they going to take a test and tell me I'm positive? And I was basically, that's what it came down to. Well, what ended up happening, my wife got pregnant. The knees were done in 84. My wife got pregnant in 88. We lost that one. And
you lost that child?
We lost that one.
How come?
Just miscarriage. That's
I
all.
See.
So doctors at the time says, well, if you want a kid, you should definitely make sure that you're okay. So I said, all right, this was in 88. I finally said, okay, I will have the blood test, get it out of the way. So that way it came back. I was negative. This is back in 88. And I was already told for 5 years that I was positive. So they came back in 88 and says, I was negative. So I says, okay, fine. My wife got pregnant again. We had my daughter in 89. And they said...
No, you'd already had your son.
Already had my son because my son was born in... he's 23, so he was born in 1981.
So this was
was it 81? Yeah, 1981.
So this was before the whole HIV business came up. He had already been born.
He was already born, okay. And the HIV started out, it was about 82, 83 in that time frame.
Okay.
And basically,
so they told you were negative.
They were negative. My wife got pregnant again. We had my daughter in 89, July, and they back in October, they said, you should do the test again. I says, okay, fine, I'll do the test again.
Why did they want you to do it again?
No idea. So I said, okay, I'll take the test again. Took the test, came back positive.
What was that like?
It was like, wait a second, you told me all these years I was infected, then it shows up negative, and then basically have another kid, and now I'm positive, so it's like, okay. And at the time, they said, oh, well, you got to go on treatment. And I says, no. I says, why do I got to go on treatment? They says, that's what we recommend. I says, well, I'm not going to go with it. And I fought them on that for, 5 years.
Why?
Why? Because they couldn't give me any real reason why to go on it.
You mean they couldn't say we can...
They couldn't give
make
me
you a, better. Or
they couldn't give me any answers. They couldn't say, okay, we can do this, because it was still experimental.
I see.
And I just said, no.
Was your wife afraid that she could get it? Was there
yeah.
any... What? How did you two handle that?
Yeah, we were rough. It was rough for a while.
In what way?
We drew further apart for a while because it was like... So every year she was going in getting tested, and it was like... So...
Were you upset that you initially got a negative and then a positive? Did you?
No, because they said, oh, we get those a lot. We get negative readings or we get positive readings.
So it caused some real tension in the family.
Yeah, for a bit.
Because what was it about the HIV versus the hemophilia, which sounds like it didn't cause tension at all?
Well, the hemophilia, you can't give it to your wife.
Yeah.
The HIV, you can give it to your wife.
Yeah.
So it's... One of those. It's a different type of disease that you have to deal with.
So it was that she was afraid she could get it.
That was one of the biggest things. That
yeah.
She could get it. So.
And how did you get? I mean.
We basically years just living together, and after a while you sort of work things out. That's all.
Were you afraid that your daughter could have gotten it?
Well. Wasn't afraid that she was going to get it because I was negative when she was born. That was when. So it was. I got tested after she was born.
So let me ask you, how did you feel having already dealt with this chronic illness that had caused so much disruption in your life out of nowhere, and no one in your family had it, and now you've given this diagnosis of HIV. How did you handle that? What do you remember when of that time?
Oh, I cursed it a little bit. It was like, why do I get this? And I was, but then like I said, I got back to the attitude where, okay, I could handle it. So basically that's what I was doing. And the doctors kept saying, you should go on treatment. And I says, why? They says, well, because your T cell count is at 500. And I said, well, it was 500 3 years ago, so give me a reason why I should be being treated. Well, a normal person is supposed to be around 1,500 for the T-cell count. I says, I got 500. I said, I've had 500 for as far back as possible. So I says, they kept asking, and my T-cell count at the time was going down. It got down into the 200s. So finally, I told them, I said, I'll go on treatment when my T-cell count drops below the 200 mark. Then we'll discuss treatment.
I see. So that's when you realized your body was changing and maybe you had to do something
about it.
It
wasn't that I was seeing any change. It was just my blood counts were changing because I was never sick from it.
Okay.
So it didn't affect me.
What about the Hep C? When did that come rolling down the pike?
Who knows?
Yeah.
somewhere in line, I don't know how many years ago, but it showed up. And couple of years ago, they had me try one of the trials and say, oh, we'll try this. And basically, it was a one-year trial.
And?
And it worked for a bit, and then just before the trial ended, it didn't work anymore. So I was like, okay. So basically, they have seen this and leave it alone now. You know, it's not doing anything. It's basically just sitting there. So it's like, we won't treat it anymore right now.
I'm just struck how you keep such a accepting attitude instead of saying, this is horrible, this isn't fair, you know.
Yeah. Just my personality.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing.
Yeah. And it's your faith, I mean.
Yeah, the faith has, there are days you're going to have your doubts, but your faith is what gets you through a lot of times.
But you think it's too just your personality, you were born with this.
I was born with the personality that basically I accept stuff.
Yeah. Did you ever, what about the class, did this affect you politically? The class action suit, the feeling that the manufacturers maybe knew, how did you deal with all of that business?
I just got in the class action suits, and they sent me all the forms, I just filled them all out, and just had to see what happened. And it worked out, I got the money from it. But part of the time, the first one, basically, that was against the pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
That one there, I had to get a lawyer after a while and basically go through paperwork. And that got bogged down on this end because basically the lawyers wouldn't wouldn't touch it. The judges wouldn't touch it because you went to court and they'd say, well, what are you doing? I'm doing this. Well, you can't do that. You can't take your kids' rights away. So it's like, okay. So finally they handled it out on the other end. In other words, they said, it's all settled. Yeah. Because my kids were basically underage. Mm-hmm. So it was, I wasn't supposed to be able to take their rights away that they could sue the pharmaceuticals. So the lawyers on the other side of the country, basically, they took care of it because they had all the forms that were all signed, and they says, we'll dispense of it from here.
But what was it like to get the money?
Paid off a few bills.
Yeah.
And then basically just put the rest of it away in case something does ever happen. You know, there's a little bit of money there. But mainly just pay off some old medical bills. Or
yeah.
Didn't really do much. No, it wasn't so much the money, it's just the fact that the pharmaceutical realized they screwed up. Basically, they made a settlement.
How did you come to terms with pharmaceuticals saying, you know, fessing up a little bit? I mean, did you?
Well, the way I looked at it was, yeah, there's always a chance of getting something. It's, you know, taking something. And basically, if you want to treat what you got, there's a chance that you might get something else. So it's like, it's one of those, if you do, you're damned. If you don't, you're damned. So you got to go down the road and say, well, this is what I got to do now, and hope it works.
I see.
In other words,
how about the rest of your family? Did they have feelings about all of this? Are you getting more problems?
Probably a little bit more. But parents...
just ran out. So we were talking about your family and their reaction to all of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, they probably show more concern, but that's because they're family.
Yeah. And did that bother you? Did you want them to be concerned?
I didn't want them, but they have the right to know.
So you accepted it, but you didn't want it.
Right, because it took me a while before I basically told anybody in the family.
Tell me about that.
Well, at the time they were saying you don't want to let people know you have it because it's going to cause all types of problems. So it was like, do you tell them or don't you tell them? So basically told the parents first, and then it was like, okay, should I tell the sisters or not? And it was like, okay, gotta tell them, which they are my sisters, so let them know.
And what about your wife? Did she know?
Yeah, because basically when I tested positive, they wanted to get the test on her, and say my daughter was just born at the time. They wanted to test on her just to make sure. And
did it affect your family's or your wife's feeling about medicine or?
No.
No,
it's. Mm-hmm.
How did your caregivers treat you at that time? How did you feel about them?
Well, they were fine. It's never had a problem with my caregivers. They, like I said, they would always tell me what was there available to me, but one of the doctors, I used to always fight with him and say, no, I don't want this now. No, I don't want this right now. And he'd say, well, this is what we recommend. And I said, no, it ain't what I'm recommending. And finally, they got me cornered one time, and they says, what will it take for you to go on treatment? I says, either the viral load's got to go higher, or my T cells got to go lower. And if you give me those numbers, then it gives me something to go with. And my T cell dropped below the 200, so that's when I said, okay, we'll treat.
Did you ever want to meet other people with hemophilia?
Never fazed me.
No,
never fazed me.
Just being the only one, did you ever want to, does anybody else have this?
Oh, I know there's a lot of people who have it, but right now I have a nephew who has it. I never see him, but he has it. But he's being treated on a every other day basis, so he won't have the problems that I had.
What's that like?
I'm glad for him. In other words, because he won't have the joint problems that I had. He may still develop joint problems, but they won't be as severe.
Right.
So.
So when you think about kids being born with hemophilia today, what do you think about it?
They have a much better chance of living more normal, because if the center pushes it, they'll basically get them on the prophylactic care, and that makes a big difference in what happens with the kid.
Do you have any, if a guy came up to you and said, "Mr. Duchesne, I have hemophilia, do you have any advice for me?" Would you have any advice for a kid dealing with a hemophilia?
Not too much, because basically it's something that you learn to live with. No matter what you get, in other words, don't matter whether it's hemophilia or whether it was diabetes, you get it, eventually you get to either accept it or you're not going to. And most people who have something that's wrong with them from the beginning, they end up accepting it and they just don't let it really bother them because it's part of their lifestyle. And so giving advice is not much. It's just mainly keep the joints healthy. That's the biggest thing.
What about to the mothers and fathers? Would you have any suggestions for them as to how they would raise their kids or talk about it with their kids?
No. There's really nothing you could really tell, because parenting isn't something that you could be taught. It's something that you learn on a day-to-day basis.
Was there anything, do you think, that your father or mother offered you that helped you cope better or worse with this? Anything that really helped or hindered your coming to terms with it?
They were just there for me. Anytime I needed them, they were always there. So
that's what you remember.
That's what I remember. The bad times after a while just become another day. It's the good times you always had. And that's basically what family comes down to. It's not the bad times. Hey, you're going to have them, but it's the bad times sort of get pushed in the background. It's the good times you always remember.
Let me ask you about money and finances. Did having hemophilia and all these diseases affect that world around you?
Yeah, a bit.
In what way?
Basically, when I turned 21, the last few years before I got out of high school, basically the state was helping my dad, because they said he shouldn't have been paying the bills, because up to a certain point, he was paying all the medical bills. Every time the bills came in, he just paid them, no questions. And finally, somebody came in and says, "You shouldn't have to do that." So basically, the state ended up picking up the tab until I turned 21. And then the day I turned 21, they basically just said, "You're on your own."
So what happened?
Well, basically, I still had to get treatment. So basically, if I needed treatment, I came in, got what I needed. Then the bills would come in. And one time, they ended up sending me out to basically Social Security to try getting aid from them. So they fill out all types of paperwork there. And they said, "Well, we can't help you, so go to welfare." Went to welfare, filled out all types of paperwork there. They said, "Well, we can't help you. Go back to Social Security." This went on for a couple of months. Finally, I sat down with one of them. I said, "You can't help me. Why?" They said, "Well, you're making $2 a month too much." At the time, I was $2 over the limit. So they says, "Take the bill, put it in the barrel." I says, "What does that prove?" They says, "It will eventually go to a collection agency." Then they says, "Once it goes to the collection agency, then you got to go back to the hospital and say, 'Hey, I can't pay.'" And basically, the hospital would end up taking care of it. So I had to do that 4 or 5 times right after I got married.
Mm-hmm.
Collection agency would start sending me letters, and I just ignored them.
Because you didn't have insurance at the time?
Didn't have any insurance.
Yeah.
So basically, ended up going back to the hospitals and say, "I can't pay it." And basically, the hospitals would fill out the paperwork and it would be gone. Then get treated again, start all over again. So 5 years after I got married, it was that. It wasn't that I didn't have insurance. Back then, they had clauses in the insurance that they didn't have to cover you for
pre-existing
conditions until so many years or so many months, so you had to make do.
Was that stressful?
A bit.
Yeah.
But it just got to the point where, okay, I can't have money, because if I have money, they're going to take it anyway. So basically, I got no money, can't take what I don't have. So it's like, So.
Did that affect what kind of work you could do, or what kind of promotions you could get, or what kind of?
Once I got into the job force, basically, it's pretty much what I went into. I went into the electronics field, and I've been for 25 years. Actually, been electronics for 26 years.
Did you go to college to get into electronics? Or did you go right out of high school?
Actually, not right out of high school, because out of high school, I had gone to college for 1 year. And then basically, I couldn't get the courses I wanted because I was going after math and science to become a teacher. And I just happened to be in the wrong school to get that. So after 1 year, I didn't go back the second year. And I held other jobs, like worked in warehouses, worked for myself for a couple of months. It was just because it's what I wanted to do. But I ended up finally going into the electronics and been doing that. And the second place I got into electronics, that was Wang Labs at the time. And basically, they were willing to put people, teach people. So I went to school for 9 months and got a, basically, I got a certificate saying I could be a technician. And I've been that ever since.
Did you ever wonder if people were going to question, because this guy has these joint problems, are we going to hire him? Did you ever worry about that? Did you ever feel?
Oh, I got jobs that basically, I knew why they didn't hire me. Because I had one job, I went out, I got the job, they hired me, called me up an hour later and said, oh, we can't hire you. But because you don't have anything and that they hired you and they fired you at the same time, you couldn't really do anything. So it was like, okay. In other words, you know what the reason was, because they ended up reading your medical history. So.
But Wang went ahead and hired you.
Yeah, they hired me.
Did you ever have an issue about telling about disclosing, you know, the hemophilia, or telling, what was that about?
Nah, hemophilia. That didn't faze me. You know, they asked, I put it down on the paper. I put it on the paper.
Yeah.
You know, it's never had an issue with it.
And you never got somehow lost anything from doing that or letting people know you have hemophilia?
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
That was never an issue.
No.
How about with the HIV business?
HIV, that was pretty much not really told to everybody, only select people.
Yeah.
But in other words, that still has no effect.
You know, when you look back on all of this, Cliff, I think what I'm interested in, a part of what I'm interested in is in this project is, do you have any advice for your caregivers, your social workers, your nurses now, as to what is helpful for people like you who have been through such a rich and complicated medical history?
Yeah, they just keep doing what they have to do, the caregivers. No, it's because I've been in the hospital a couple times since I've been an adult, actually. One time it was for bilateral knee replacements. Another time it was for bilateral hip replacements. I was in because I had got kidney stones from one of the medications that they gave me when I was on HIV. And basically, they all do fine.
Is there any attitude that you've picked up that's been either helpful or not?
No, because most of the time, all the caregivers I've had, they've all been excellent.
You haven't, so you've really felt that way.
Yeah.
You have no memories of things that you left going,
no,
that wasn't good,
no,
or that was particularly helpful.
And it was because, like, when I had my hips done, they were just about ready to send me home after a week. Because I was after a week, I had one hip that stopped bleeding out. And one of the nurses happened to come in, and I told her. She stayed there with me the whole time until basically they got me up back into surgery to take care of it all. So the caregivers, you know, always had a problem. They were always right there.
Do you think hemophilia has affected you in a positive way, in any way? Or even all of these medical?
Probably just makes you stronger.
You think? In what way?
Because you're always having to cope with something. You know, it's nothing's just black and white. It's okay. if you do this, you're going to have this consequence. If you do this, you're going to have this consequence. So with the hemophilia, you know what your consequences are. You know what could happen. And if you basically push it, you're going to end up with a bleed, and then you've got to suffer for a few days.
So how does that make you stronger?
You realize things, everybody's got limits. You can't do everything you want to do. Nobody can. Everybody's got a limit. And you just got to find out what your limits are, and you try getting to them without actually causing a problem. And sometimes that's tough, because there's something you want to do, you're going to try it, and you may pay for it. But
you think it's important for you yourself to find your own limit.
Yeah. Because I remember when I worked for myself for a summer, basically I had taken a job and I'd given a person a time frame that I could do it in. And my dad just looked at me and said, "You can't do it in that amount of time." And I says, "Why not?" He says, "Too big of a job." He says, "You're biting off more than you can chew." I says, "No, I said I could do it." So to prove him, I had to do it in that amount of time. It should have been a 2-day project, but I did it in the 1 day, like I told the person. So it was.
So in some ways, you had more determination,
right,
that you were gonna.
If you're told you can't do something, you get to watch me. I'll do it. And basically, I still have that same drive, because if somebody challenges me to something, I will try to meet the challenge.
It's interesting, because what many parents struggle with today is how protective or how much they should let their son go. You know, that whole balance of safety, but wanting them to live their life. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Not really. Because basically, the rules I had basically when I was a kid, when I was up until I was 16, basically, you had to be in the house by like 10 o'clock. Okay, 10 o'clock, okay, that's fine. During the summer, it was 10 o'clock. During the week, during school time, it was probably 8 o'clock. But that was just rules of the house. And as I got my license, the rules changed, because basically it was, when does your license expire? And at 16, it expires at 1 o'clock. So it was, you know what time you have to be in the house by. So you always, basically, you challenge once in a while, but most of the time, yeah, I always abided. If they said 1 o'clock, it was 1 o'clock. You know, it's.
But my thought is around just, don't climb, don't run, don't this, don't that. You might get a bleed, this might happen.
Well, back then, that's what would happen.
Yeah.
Today, most of the kids who are getting it, they're probably being on prophylactic care, so they're being treated every other day, so they don't have that. They'll still get bleeds, but their bleeds are much milder, because they're keeping a level of factor in their system. And that's what my nephew finds out. In other words, he gets his bleeds, but they're not as severe as probably what my bleeds would have been. So.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to get bleeds no matter what.
You're going to still get bleeds. It's just the severity of the bleed.
Yeah.
Because if you're being treated every other day, you know, you're going to get a bleed, but the bleed may only last a couple of hours, and probably once you start treating it, you're pretty much all set. Whereas if you're older like I am, and you're not on every other day program, you get a bleed. The bleed may last 2 days or 3 days. So it's the severity becomes the issue.
When I told you I wanted to interview you for this, did you have any thoughts about what you wanted to say or in thinking? I don't even know if you thought about it before you actually sat down here today.
No thoughts on that. Actually, when you first approached me, I had said no.
Right.
And you talked to me that day, and I agreed.
Yeah.
Because you said it could probably be a benefit to the people further down the road.
Mm-hmm. So that's what sort of changed.
That's basically what.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you today, though, that you think might be useful, or just something, some experience you had that I didn't somehow tap into?
No, pretty much got it all. In other words, like I said, the biggest thing is I find that you got to live one day at a time. You can't try living down the road. You got to live what's happening now. You know, it's because you never know what's going to come up tomorrow. And that's the hardest thing. You know, it's.
What's the hardest?
Living one day at a time. Because most people want to live, oh, this is what I'm going to do down here. Most of the time, you can't really look at that. Because you have problems. You never know if one of the problems is going to flare up, whether it's going to be fine. So you basically get up in the morning, okay, I can do this today. Fine, you do it. If you can't do it, oh, I can't do it today. So it's basically it's a day-to-day basis thing. It's,
So you're saying then otherwise you're just setting yourself up for total frustration because you never know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's coming down. You know, it's, if you take one day at a time, you can deal with one day. You can't deal with weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm. Or the what-ifs, you mean?
The what-ifs. In other words, you deal with the what-ifs when we get there.
I see. That's can you do that, actually?
Pretty much. Pretty much. Because, like, right now, my HIV meds, they may be changing me again. So it's... Once that happens, go with the room.
Has this changed your perspective on dying or living or your philosophy of life, you know?
No. Biggest thing is, like, just one day at a time. You know, and some days it's not a day at a time, it's an hour at a time. You know, it's, some days you have bad days, so yeah, you go 1 hour at a time and you get through it and you say, okay, I made it through that. Go a little further. But
so just deal with what's in front of you.
Just deal with what you're dealing with right away. Don't try dealing with something that hasn't got there yet. And basically that's why I keep telling my kids, you know, it's deal with what you're dealing with. Don't try dealing with something that isn't a problem yet. You know, it's don't worry about it. You can't stop something that's going to happen further down the road because you don't know what's going to happen. Because if we did, we'd avoid it. And we don't know what to avoid.
Well, Cliff, I want to thank you very much for doing this. And it's just been a pleasure.
Okay.